Accession number 10165, reel number 15.
Martin McLean, reel 15. When did you first hear about the 1st Battalion's posting overseas to China?
It came on battalion orders, an announcement to the whole battalion and all concerned that the battalion was going to go on draft overseas to Shanghai. And that the 2nd Battalion, which was in India, actually they'd moved from India to Khartoum, would move home in their placement so that two regular battalions swap over. And it was anticipated at the time of the move that they would both pass in different troop ships in the Mediterranean, which they did do, only within sight of each other, not talking distance, but only within sight of each other. This thing came to my notice more prominent when we just accept a draft of this description, part and parcel of your life. And then the adjutant sent for me, which is Captain Stallard, and said, we've been noticing Corporal McLean, you along with others, you have just more than 2 years' service to do, and that we don't think it's beneficial to take you overseas with us if you don't intend to sign on now. Well, it was like blackmail to me, enforcing the lads for to sign on. Some did, others didn't. And if I had 2 years or less to do, I would have had to make up my mind there and then. Because if you didn't, then you're out of the army. But since I had more time to do than the 2 years, they viewed it in a more compassionate manner. And I said, well, I haven't made up my mind yet. I'd met a young girl in Gates in Newcastle, the wife now, and that we were courting and were anticipating getting married, and I didn't want to go off to India, which was a long term of duty over there, before we had decided whether to get married or not. So I refused. I said no. And the adjutant said, well, that's it. You won't be going on draft. So as the draft, as the battalion became getting more momentum for the move over to Shanghai, again I was sent for by the adjutant. He says, I've got a job for you. He says, I want you to take over the band boys. Now, the band boys was a selective sort of a job for an NCO because he had a man of... I don't want to boast about myself, but I'm telling you the truth in these things, and so that you have the true opinions of it, whether you like it or not, is that a man was selected for his high standard of morale and his method of adopting life and things like that, and his method of discipline and drill. He was specially selected to be in charge of band boys who, as you know, if led the wrong way, can turn out a right riotous little mob. And so I was sent over to where the band boys were, and there was a corporal called Kens in charge of them, and he was now moving off the signals on promotion, signal platoon. And he had gone off, and the boys apparently were on their own, and were now in Blackdown Camp in Camberley, in Surrey, Camberley area, Surrey. And I went over this two-storey, brand-new building, and it was amazing, because there was a great pile of mattresses lying outside, and there was young bodies shooting out the window, jumping out the second-storey window onto these pile of mattresses. It was the young band boys, or the young lads that had been recruited for the 2nd Battalion, just gone wild. They'd got all the mattresses outside and just piled them on the ground below, and they were doing jumps out the window from two stories up and landing on these mattresses and running around the house into the building to do again. Well, I put a stop to that, not from the idea of the lads not having a great bit of fun, but it looked as if somebody could do serious injury to themselves, like a broken arm, broken leg, which would have finished their army altogether. So I took over the band boys. The 1st Battalion went off overseas, and it was still doubtful whether I had to join the 1st Battalion or not, because although I hadn't signed on, I'd been informed that I may still have to go. I was sad to see the 1st Battalion going, because I was one of the battalion rugby players, and there they were, all off, all my pals, all my mates once again, and they left behind them in, we'd moved from Blackdown Camp to Woking Barracks, in Knaphill Barracks. It was an old pre-war jail, had been turned into a barracks for troops, all part of the 2nd Division area, and we had moved from Blackdown into the barracks at Knaphill in Woking for the, forget the name of the barracks, I think it was Inkerman Barracks.
Who else had stayed with you? Because most of the battalion obviously went as a unit. So who was left behind besides the band boys?
The people who were mainly left behind were people who were either too short of service to do overseas, or they had equipment and stores to hand over to the battalion, or they had been overseas and done a long tour of duty previously. And so there's quite a number of people, say 60, left behind. Some to hand over stores to the second battalion when they came home, and then joined the 1st battalion. And others were known as just rear details for work and the maintenance of the barracks, etc. Well, they put me in a large barrack room with all these boys, 44 band boys, 44 boys. And it was bedlam in there at first, and then I was the only NCO with them. No one else in charge of them, but I report to Captain Bond, who was the senior officer left behind with the rear details, in the event of wanting any information or any discipline or anything of that nature. But I got the boys under control, and we used to go for a drill in the morning, or for cross-country walks or runs, or for long walks across the moors, go swimming, and do anything to occupy their times. And apart from that, the Shana parades, which they used to do at Fenham Barracks. But I was teaching the young lads how to look after the uniform, crease it, make themselves look smart, get their kit up to standard. All this was part of the daily training.
Did you get on well with them?
I did, yes. Well, it wasn't a matter of getting on with them. A disciplinarian NCO kept himself apart from them, you know. He was there to dish out orders and say they were carried out, but not to socialise with them. But I didn't... I turned a blind eye many a time to them skylarking in the back room, throwing things around, like pillows at skylarking, which we used to do as young soldiers, let's face it. And I let them have a lot of freedom in that way, but discipline was tight. Barrack room inspection and everything of that nature, which a normal soldier does. Well, the 2nd Battalion came home, and I lost the band boys for nearly a whole day. They were carrying equipment and stores and personal kit for the soldiers coming home, and it was nice to see them. All sunburnt men had been overseas for 12 years. One had been overseas for about 17 years, and had just returned home. All sun-bronzed and fit-looking men, and they had these young boys carrying their equipment in the barrack rooms as they were moving in, and that they had to move into. Now, giving these lads a few coppers, and so the little band boys were making money, who were on a low rate of pay. So I turned a blind eye to it, as long as I could have them under my control later on, because we had a system in the army, not mine, Queen's regulations. Boys had to be under strict surveillance at all times, and they had to be in the barrack rooms by 8 o'clock at night. They were allowed in the canteen for a short while, again under supervision of me or the battalion NCO, where they could have their cups of tea, their wads. They weren't allowed to drink beer, they weren't allowed to smoke, and this was one of the hardest jobs of the lot, trying to stop them smoking, because we knew they used to sneak around somewhere and have a sly smoke. And then the little lads come back, they had plenty of money, and they come back with armfuls of old KD, khaki drill, shorts, jackets, towels that the lads had brought back with them. In fact, a lot of them had just brought the old stuff back to wrap up their valued treasures that was bought in India, like ivory pieces and mahjong sets and presents they brought home for the family. And once home, they were just dumping this stuff, tunics and trousers and shirts. And the boys were collecting them, so I had a rare sort out there making them dump them out of the barrack room. Anyway, the lads got something out of it. And then the bandmaster rose, who was the bandmaster, he came, saw the lads, and he got a hold of me. He says, well, you're in charge of them. He says, now what I intend doing with them, he says, I'm going to interview all of them and fit them out with a band instrument. And so immediately I said, hey, band instrument, sir. I said, no, I know nothing about instruments, know nothing about band, music, no. Drill, discipline, yes, but not music. And I said, I can't answer for any damage to these instruments. He says, not to worry. He says, all these instruments have been replaced. We're getting brand new stuff for the battalion band. We've been waiting of this, and it was from a place called Boozy and Hawks, Aldershot. So he says, don't worry about the instruments. So he fit each man out with an instrument, and this was one of the most horrendous experiences of my army service. I'm not talking about fighting, but I'm talking about peacetime life. There was 40-odd of them, and there were two huge barrack rooms, a majority in one and some in the other, and I used to live in the corner of them. And I had to sit them down an hour of a morning and an hour of an afternoon. I make them play these instruments. Well, you had the little lads coming up crying and say, "Sir, I didn't want to play an instrument like this. He says, I want one of them trumpets and want one of this." So I said, "Well, the bandmaster's interviewed you all, and that's the instrument you play with. Lots of clarinets, lots of trombones, the big big instruments and all this, the trombones, and you name it, they're all there." And I used to sit the men, on the boys on the bed, and I'd say, "Right, play." And if they didn't play, I'd chivvy them. And you had the most horrible noise come from that back room. I used to have a bit of fun because of an afternoon, the people who were on the rear details, mainly old soldiers I mentioned before, lived in the barrack room upstairs above us. We were on the ground floor. And I used to go to a window and get the boys on the bed and say, "Right, play." Well, all the old soldiers and everything had sneaked away to bed and all, sitting in the barrack rooms talking and scat, whatever they have to do in the barrack room. And once these lads started up, they nearly lifted the floor off the barrack room. And just looking out the window, you could see the old soldiers scurrying away from the building just like ants. You know, never looking back, just away as fast as they could from the Nazis. Well, I put up with this for 2 months, apart from all of the drill and the walks and the things that we had to do to keep the boys occupied and fit. And then the 2nd Battalion lads came home, and I found one day I'd been out, and there's the sergeant in charge of the band and some of the band NCOs sitting in the barrack room with the boys smoking and letting the boys smoke. Well, they got rollicked, and one of them became a local bandmaster here. I won't mention names, but he was a sergeant, and so I rollicked him and everything. So in no time, they report me to the bandmaster, and the bandmaster had me up before him. But I told him in no uncertain terms, I solely was responsible for the military discipline of these boys. Regulations stated the boys would not smoke, and in my presence they would not smoke. What they done outside is not doing me, but not in the barrack room, and set a bad example of those who didn't smoke. So I got my way, and then I wasn't settled with this job. So the battalion was now settling down for training within the getting up to military standards in England. And I asked if I could go transfer from the band to a rifle company. I went and saw the company commander of the company concerned, my company, Major Simpson. I think it was Simpson, yes. And told him that I would desire to leave the band, and that I wanted to progress in the army, and at this I could see the stalemate. I'd done quite a few months at it, and I thought it was sufficient. And he told me that, not to be so daft, it was a plum job, this, that, blah, 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 blah. But I was determined to leave, because through this incident of the non-smoking, it caused a lot of bad feeling between me and the other NCOs. And sadly, some of these lads I knew very well at the finish. They were killed in France. And through the war, a lot of them went. But anyway, I decided I was going to leave the band, and I left. And the battalion was down in a camp called Little Danhill, down in the south somewhere, Little Danhill camp. I think it was down about Hants. And I got a message to go and report to the adjutant. And when I went to see the adjutant, the bandmaster was there. They want me to go back to Woking Barracks immediately and take charge of the boys again. Apparently, some of the boys hadn't been good enough to make musicians. And the idea now was to train boys of this nature into a trade, like an order room clerk, like help with the armory, different little trades that they had in the army, to ascertain that they were useful not only to themselves but to the army. And one young lad, whose name I won't mention, got put in the order room. And the majority of the battalion had been away, all the officers had been away at this camp. It was a battalion camp, I think it was army manoeuvres, I'm not sure. And I was sent for, and I was told that they wanted me to go back to barracks. And I asked the reason why. Well, I got out of it. I told them, no, it wasn't my job. I didn't get these lads in trouble. But they took us off it and sent somebody else. What happened was, the young lad who was working in the order room got a hold of the passes, which entitles a man to travel free on the railway, warrants, they call them. And he made out warrants and he sold them to the band boys. And the Biden boys all packed up that weekend and were going off on holiday, unknowing that they were doing wrong, a lot of them. The younger ones were led by the elder ones. And they all got to Woking Station and they started clamouring with their tickets at the door. And the ticket collector, who'd lived in this garrison town for many years, knew that there was something unusual in these boys having these passes. So he held the boys up and sent for the military police, who roped them in. And before this, the lads start hanging around walking, and they start running around wild, pinching the cigarette machines off the wall and taking the cigarettes and the money and the sweet machines. They went berserk for a while, and they were roped in by the military police and brought back to camp. And I was now sent back to discipline them again. But my argument with the people concerned was, no, I said I had these boys well disciplined, but the people who took them over from me, including the band NCOs, had allowed a great inflow of ill discipline among the boys. I said they were responsible, and I think they should be the ones that's got to put it right. I said I'm happy with the company, and I said I'd prefer to be where I was. So that's how it happened. And so I stayed with the 2nd Battalion. Short while after this, and I was now in D Company, Don Company. And they were introducing 3-inch mortars into the battalions once again. Before the war, before all this happened, they had the old Stokes trench mortar in the First World War, but they didn't continue it. I don't know how long after the war, but they didn't have it as a part of a battalion equipment. So they'd invented a new 3-inch mortar, which lobbed shells up with great effects. I was a great lover of the gun, into the enemy lines. And I was sent off on a 3-inch mortar course, once again, back to Netherhaven, where I'd been on a small arms course. And I was down there for a fortnight. About 6 weeks. And qualified in the gun. You couldn't get a Q1 or a Q2 or a distinguished in this. You either got a pass or a fail, because it was a short course. The only time you could get a qualification of Q1 or D, that description, are what they call the long qualifying courses. So I done well on this course and
could
came back.
Could you just explain how you fired the 3-inch mortar, because it's not such a common weapon as some of the others. What was the procedure?
Well, a 3-inch mortar was, you had it in three parts. You had the barrel, you had a base plate, and you had the tripod. Three different lads carried these into action. They'd put the base plate on the bottom, and the gun was just a hollowed out lump of tubing, which was sealed up on one end, and you placed one end into the base plate and twisted it, and it locked in the base plate. A base plate was a huge, it was 27 pounds in weight, which, when the gun fired, was spiking the ground and remained still and hold the gun in position. And the tripod was another piece of thing that you put on the front of the gun, on the front of the barrel. You lowered the barrel down, put the tripod over, and secured it in the ground, so there's two arms stretching out from the gun to give it support. And on this you could get elevation and direction by traversing either with a handle or elevating with a screw handle. And in there you dropped a bomb. A bomb was 10 pound in weight, and they had two types of bomb in vogue then. One was the smoke bomb, which could drop out smoke shells, smoke bombs, in front of the advance or in front of the enemy or in front of anyone to screen with smoke the different parties. If you want to make a movement of troops advancing, you want to screen them from the enemy, you'd put smoke down. And if you are wanting a movement of a patrol of men, the same way, you'd put a smoke down so they could move unhampered and unseen. And then you had the HE bomb, which was had devastating effect, because it hit and the nose was so, the fuse was in the nose, and as soon as the nose hit the ground or touched it, it sent a plunger back into the thing and exploded this 10-pound bomb with lethal effect, and these pieces used to go out to 150 yards. Well, I went on this course to learn all this weapon, and I absorbed because I loved the gun. And from there on, we start getting in young lads to learn the gun. And I'm sad to say, although some of them became my good friends, when the companies were asked to give you men for the go into 3-inch mortar platoon, you got their rejects. Men that were slovenly, men that couldn't march, that were always falling out in the marches. men that were constantly sick and all of sort nature, unless you were lucky, as I was at one instance, where I got a lump of a draft of men who came from the depot, a draft of men as part of the squad of the men, say about 8 of them to train as new 3-inch mortar men. They were good. But I'm afraid the others weren't the type of soldier I would like in the mortar platoon, but you had to put up with it. And then we developed from there. We played as soldiers, we worked, and we worked hard.
How many guns did you have in the mortar platoon?
2.
And there were two. What, there was a mortar platoon in each company, was there?
No, there was a mortar platoon in the battalion, just 1. 2 guns in the whole of the battalion. I'll talk more about that later. Because prior to this, we had, as I said, the old Stokes mortar of the pre-war, which is useless for our training. But when we got these new tripods and guns, we put them into a lot of use. Well, we're training all these people from different companies, and I was rejecting them, and so was the platoon sergeant major, who was a lad called Quarthro, Harry Quarthro. He was rejecting them as much as I was, as unlikely to be 3-inch mortar men, so we got more to train, more to train. And then time came on when war was imminent, and they start calling up reservists. Now, this is where we really shone in getting good men. They were sent over to us, men to train in the 3-inch mortar, who they didn't know the qualities of. And we got some very, very good men from them indeed. Men who were soldiers, who'd done their 7 years in the army, now they're doing their 5-year reserve, and were caught and called up for the war. Or prior to the war, they're being called up for additional training, and we got these lads, which stayed on our books. And the platoon was, we had about 8, 16, about 28 men in the platoon. We had our own trucks, we had our guns, we had our ammunition, and we used to go over into the ranges now and again when we got an allocation of ranges and do a live shoot, which, although the men were on mortar drill, they weren't very enhanced with it at the time because a lot of heavy loads to carry, only into action, but we had lorries to carry them, so they didn't have to carry them far, other than we had what is called long carry drill, where the men carried the weapons and the ammunition as far as you could make them. Anyway, when the men went to shoot these weapons and saw the effect of them on the moors, just on their explosion and their effect on targets that we placed out, they became entranced with the gun, and they, like me, became good mortar men, and they wanted to know more about it. Well, the only thing we could teach them, apart from them knowing how a 3-inch mortar worked and the content of the shell, the bomb, and its effect on what likely enemy would be, was to teach them the method of bracketing, which is the same with the artillery, finding the range, the proper range for the target that we had to take on. Well, as time went on, war was imminent.
Did you get promotion again? I think you've been made Lance Sergeant sometime around this time, 1938.
I was now a sergeant. Sorry, I jumped that. I got sergeant from Lance Sergeant, and I was now a sergeant 3-inch mortar platoon. And
was there any ceremony when you became a sergeant? Because in some battalions and regiments, there's a special routine.
None at all. The routine was the same as before. It was another promotion, so it was a chance for all the people in the mess to have a pint on you. So you were debited with the 40-odd pints of beer for all the WOs and sergeants on the strength of the battalion, which included the education people, the ROC people, everyone had touched the battalion. So it was something that was accepted, and you just took it with a good part, and that was it. But you were dressed the same as a sergeant, as a Lance Sergeant, or at least you were dressed the same as a sergeant. You didn't have to buy any additional kits, so that was just the initial ceremony. No additional duties, because you're already done the same duties as a Lance Sergeant. I had this Sergeant Major called Qualthro in my platoon, a hell of a nice bloke, from the Isle of Man, a fanatical soldier. He had been the signal sergeant prior to this, before he got this promotion. And he'd see him stand in the square with a signal flag, sending off semaphore messages for hours at a time. And it was a feat in itself, because your muscles cramped, but he used to keep himself practiced in sending these semaphore messages. Anyway,
who was your officer?
We had no officer. Harry Qualthro was the man in charge, and I was the next man down. We had another sergeant as well, 2 sergeants, 1 for each section of the 3-inch mortars. And as time progressed, we now mechanised. I've got a motorbike. We've got two motorbikes in the motor platoon, one for me and one for the platoon commander. Why I had a one, I had to take over the platoon commander's job now and again. And I was down in the garage one day maintaining the motorbikes, which we had to do ourselves. Doesn't matter what rank you are responsible for your own vehicle. And I used to take a pride in this motorbike, the other two motorbikes. And I was sent for by the quartermaster, a fellow called Ozzy Pearson, a porter quartermaster, and he had a funny way of speaking, so I went out with him. I want you at the mobilisation stores to draw your two warlike 3-inch mortars. Well, mobilisation stores, in each battalion had a huge store in which they stored 3-inch mortars, signal equipment, rifles, weapons of all description, brand new, which, as we were training as a regular soldiers, our rifles, weapons used to get knocked about and they were considered not serviceable for war. So we were issued with all this new kit, and I was delighted to think that we were getting these two new 3-inch mortars, because with all the practice that we had with ours, the elevating screw and the traversing screw on the tripod had both became so worn that when we fired them on the ranges, you had to hold the handles because the handles used to fly around, because the screws were so badly worn that there was no, not only stability with the gun, there's no accuracy with the gun. And if you're firing overhead shoot over your own troops, you're liable to drop the shells onto them with the screw reducing itself. And I was delighted to think we're getting these guns. So I went along the stores full of enthusiasm, got these great big chests out which carried a 3-inch mortar, took some of the lads down. We got the guns out, looked at them lovingly, all full of verdigris. Not verdigris, they've got a special name, mineral jelly red. All covered in mineral jelly red to preserve them from rust. And what we are going to do with these guns, and blow me, up comes a truck with an officer and some NCOs from the London Scottish. It was the London Scottish, or the Inns of Court regiment. And the quartermaster says, "There you are, hand them over to them." We had to hand all our mobilisation stores to this territorial unit. And I tried to talk the quartermaster to give them all the stores, but no, all our brand new stuff went over to the territorial army. And we went over.
When was that?
That was just prior to our Great War. That would be early part 1939. War was imminent. And everybody's getting keyed up for it then.
Now, you'd just been married as well. Were you in married quarters then?
Yes, I was in married quarters. I had a nice married quarter in number 26. Same number as this. Married quarter. And we're having a nice royal time of it. I'd like to tell you just a little bit. Did I tell you about the wedding?
No. That was in November 38, wasn't it?
Yes, November 38. I must come back on that just to show you, to characterise the type of man that was in the army. We decided to get married because the wife and I, during this 3-inch mortar course, we had such a furious argument with letters, through letters, you know. And if you do writing to people over a long period, you find that you say something, it's multiplied and it's multiplied, and you argue and argue with each other through letters over a long time, whereas if we can get together for a couple of minutes, it's settled. So when I came back from this course that weekend, I applied to the battalion before I came back and asked if I could have a long weekend to go to Newcastle. And so I got my long weekend pass and went up to see the girlfriend. We patched it up and I said, "Well, look, I'm going back to Woking as a pal of mine in married quarters. If you wish, you can come down for a week and stop with us. Stop with them. I'll be in the barracks. You can stop with them in married quarters." But it's a subterfuge because they're not allowed to take strangers in the barracks. You've got to be her niece. So it was arranged that she was her aunt and the daughter was the niece. And these people treated us great. We went down there and the girlfriend was made very much at home by the older people of the married quarters, the lasses who had been to India, been all over the place with the army, who lived in married quarters, had a nice, respectable married life now. Some had bits of tarnished records, but that's neither here nor there. You get that in every walk of life. And a time for the wife to think of be going home. The girl, the girlfriend, to be going home. We planned to get married in November. So this must have been early end of July or August, I think, when she was down. And she says, "Oh, I'm not going home." She says, "I'm stopping here." "And why?" She says, "Well, there's a friend of Mr. Walker down this road there, a sergeant. His sister had been made pregnant by a lad of the DLI, and she had come down on an excursion train." Now, an excursion train from Newcastle to London was only 10 shilling them days. It's to compare the price of today.